Many of us in this digital age are overwhelmed with the amount of information available literally at our fingertips. We despair of ever being able to organize it all in a way that makes sense to us and being able to keep track of information we might need again. I know I was dismayed recently to realize that when I clip an article from the New York Times on my Kindle and pull it up later, it doesn't appear in the same user-friendly format as when I'm reading each day's issue. Well, surprising as it might seem, this feeling of being inundated with media is not new to our age of unlimited storage in the cloud. Readers in the 19th century felt the same way, as newspapers and magazines proliferated and got cheaper. Their solution was the scrapbook, which Ellen Gruber Garvey says often served as their own personal history books. Garvey is a professor of English and Women's and Gender Studies at New Jersey City College and author of the book Writing with Scissors, American Scrapbooks from the Civil War to the Harlem Renaissance. I met up with her in New York a couple months ago and asked how an English teacher ended up being interested in scrapbooks, which seem more like history than literature.
Well, I'm very interested in reading as well as writing. So I'm interested in what ordinary people make of their reading, how they understand what they're reading, what they think they're looking at when they read it. Now, that's very different from what academics do with their reading. So when I discovered these scrapbooks that I wrote about, I realized I had a gold mine, that they were a way of understanding something about what 19th century ordinary people and extraordinary people as well did with the newspapers that they read. Now, you may think of English teachers as focusing only on famous novelists or fiction for that matter, or essays or poetry, but more and more there's a great interest in the vast amount of stuff we read. And I think part of why that is that as our reading habits have changed enormously with the growth of the internet, we all are browsing madly, we all are skimming and taking in vast amounts of information and having to decide what not to read, perhaps more often than we have to decide what to read, that we've changed what really comes in front of our faces. And we also realize that most of our reading is not rarefied stuff. It's not important, you know, it's not necessarily scientific articles, it's not fiction, it's not high quality literature, it's just all the stuff, all the writing that there is in the world. This was something that was striking people in the 19th century very much. They realized there was altogether too much in the world to read. On the other hand, they realized that they were seeing a lot of cheap printed matter that was suddenly available to them, that all sorts of newspapers had gotten very cheap. By the end of the 19th century, magazines were cheap, and suddenly there was this wealth of written matter that was really too much to manage. If you saved it all, you would end up with big piles of paper in your house, but how would you find anything again? There were no indexes to newspapers, not published indexes, and so they started making scrapbooks just to hang on to the articles that mattered to them. Now, this is very similar to what we do now with favorites lists, blog rolls, news aggregation, all the different digital methods we use to save items we want to look at again or that we think are important or we want to pass along to somebody else. They did this by clipping items from the newspaper and pasting them into scrapbooks. Now, different from all those digital methods that we have now of hanging on to information, these people left a permanent record. They left those scrapbooks. So for us now, they are a way of understanding ordinary people's lives and reading, what mattered to them, how they made sense of the newspaper. So they're a very precious and extraordinary record. Teachers' colleges recommended that teachers do it. There were lots and lots of articles in the 19th century press about why you'd want to keep a scrapbook, how the best minds of the country kept scrapbooks, orators kept scrapbooks, and this is why they always had something to say, and Abraham Lincoln kept scrapbooks, Frederick Douglass kept scrapbooks. Mark Twain had his hands all over scrapbooks. You know, if you had to take out the glue pot, that was quite a production. So he invented what he called Mark Twain's patented self-pasting scrapbook. It had pages with strips of glue on them, which you would moisten with a sponge, like an old postage stamp, and then you would just slap down your clipping. You didn't have to get the glue pot out. And that was a wonderful thing, because in patenting this blank book, he actually made more money from it than from some of the written books that he wrote. And this had to do with something that's very much in the news these days, intellectual property. In the 19th century, copyright laws were not very strong, and things just got reprinted freely. Newspaper editors would, as a matter of course, cut. They, in fact, had special scissors editors or exchange editors who would go through other people's papers, other newspapers, and cut out articles from them to use in their own papers. And very often they would just drop the author's name if there was one on there. Most news was anonymous, but art, you know, stories and poems and so forth had names. But as long as it said that it was by exchange from another newspaper, they didn't worry about it. That was enough for them. For the authors, however, it was not so great. And Twain was not happy about this. In fact, his very first story using the pseudonym Mark Twain included a character named Mark Twain in the story so that nobody could snip his credit from that story.
And how did you become aware of them, and how did you find the ones that you kind of review?
The first one I saw like this was because I was on another project that involved a very different kind of scrapbook of advertising matter. But I was in a bookstore, in a used bookstore that actually turned out to be owned by a retired English professor in Massachusetts. And I was with somebody, and he who knew her, and he said, you know, that I was interested in scrapbooks. And she said, oh, have you ever seen anything like this? And she handed me this book. Now, it looked like a book of Puritan sermons. And I thought, well, Puritan sermons, not exactly what I work on, what I'm interested in. But I opened it up, and it was not the sermons of Oliver Cromwell's chaplain, as it appeared to be, but rather a scrapbook. A farm woman in the 1880s had clipped the farm papers, the papers that people on farms very often subscribe to, and she had pasted in a whole bunch of stories into this, covering over the sermons. And she the very first story in it was a story by Mary Wilkins Freeman called The Revolt of Mother. And it's a story I knew very well. It was reprinted in the 1970s as a feminist story, because it's about a woman whose husband has refused to build a decent house for them for 40 years, and instead keeps putting up new barns, new outbuildings, which means she has more work because she has to take care of the dairying of the cows and so forth. So he's gone off to bring in more cows or more horses or something, and has built a new barn. She moves the family into the new barn because it's a much nicer house than the one they're living in. It's a story of the woman taking control of space. And then I looked at this scrapbook. This woman had taken control of the paper space of the Book of Puritan Sermons. She had covered it over with a whole different kind of domestic religion in which women make better houses, better homes for their family, partly to keep them out of the billiard parlor and the saloon. But this was a kind of religion of domesticity that was more in vogue by the end of the 19th century. And she obliterated the Puritan sermons with them. I was completely hooked. I thought, wow, what is this? This way of speaking back to power, of speaking back in a very quiet way and in a personal way, but absolutely.
So one of the stories that you told was really interesting was of a woman who was moving from the East to go settle in the West and sort of use the scrapbook to send herself forward some things that she thought she might find useful or would want to know. Talk about that.
I was in an archive in Nebraska looking through some scrapbooks, and I was reading one that it seemed to be by a farm woman. And, you know, it had the kind of stuff you'd find in a farm scrapbook. It had recipes. It had how to, you know, take care of the scaly rashes in sheep, or what to do about this or that with your children. And I thought, well, this is what a farm woman would have clipped from the papers. It had some poetry as well and some songs. And then I looked at the dates for this person, and I saw that, in fact, when she made the scrapbooks, that is the dates from the clippings, showed that she had made this when she was an unmarried school teacher in the East. And of course, since it was in Nebraska, I thought she was homesteading in the West. And she was planning to marry and homestead. She was, in fact, eventually Willa Cather's Aunt Frank. And so that's how I actually had all that information, because it was in the Willa Cather archives. But the fact that she was thinking ahead, that she clipped all these things that really had no relevance to her current life, it was like Pinterest, this you know, the new digital form of saving pictures, usually, and a lot of women, people use them for their kind of future interests, to plan or fantasize about their lives in the future. And she was doing a very similar thing. She was saving provisions for herself. She was assuming that she wouldn't have these newspapers, perhaps, or that she wouldn't have a newspaper she trusted, and she presumably trusted that she was getting good advice on how to hang hogs from the newspaper she was reading. And so she saved all of these items that she imagined possibly needing 10 years down the line in her new life as a homesteader in Nebraska.
I was just thinking about how, you know, I have a Kindle and I have the New York Times on my Kindle, and so you can clip an article. So the things that I clip are recipes, and mostly, occasionally it's like something that I might want to do a show about, or, but mostly it's recipes or reviews of books that I want to read, but I'm not going to buy them right now because I already have too many that I bought that I haven't read. It kind of reminds me of that. You know, you talk about people talking back to power through these scrapbooks. You talk about them as a way of people who didn't really have access to the press, like African Americans and women, especially poor people, being able to essentially make their own press. What do you learn from reading the scrapbooks or looking at the scrapbooks that you don't learn from the original material?
That's a wonderful question. To some extent, of course, you do see the original material, but it's very differently constituted. It's put together in a whole different way. And that itself tells us a good deal about the reader. And most readers don't keep diaries about their reading. They don't say, "Oh, I read this really interesting article." And just as if you clip something from the paper now using your Kindle, you might, you know, you won't note annotate it necessarily. You just know that's what it's for. What you learn is how people could put things together in a way that made sense to them, what they chose to leave out or to include. Now, sometimes that's perhaps the opposite of speaking back to power. In a sense, I'm thinking now of a Confederate scrapbook that I saw that was made probably by a woman in Savannah. She kept the scrapbook for a couple of years during the Civil War, and you can track her understanding about what slaves thought. That is, early on in the scrapbook, she saves all these clippings about enslaved people wanting to join the Confederacy and help out with the war, and obviously they existed in the newspaper, or she couldn't have used them, but she also chose them. And she didn't choose other things. I was able to look at some of the papers she clipped from, so I could see what she actually chose against and what she chose not to keep. Early on in the war, she saves these articles about slaves wanting to join the Confederacy. As the war goes on, fewer of those, and more articles about the scariness of armed slaves and of armed black people and what it means. And it sort of starts turning into what becomes later the lost cause ideology, and also the kinds of lies about black rapists that were excuses for lynching a couple of a decade or so later. And we can also see that in people who are speaking back to power. So I'm thinking now of the 400 scrapbooks made by William Henry Dorsey, who was an educated black man in Philadelphia, the son of an escaped slave, who was also an amateur artist, and kept something he called Dorsey's Museum. He collected books as well on black life. And he made extraordinary scrapbooks. He just did that for four decades or so of saving clippings. And when he puts them on the page, they have a very different meaning than in the newspapers where he found them. One scrapbook I talk about a lot in Writing with Scissors is one called Colored Centenarians. He, for four decades, saved every article he could find about black people over the age of 100. And he found about 200 of these articles. He saved them all in a small scrapbook, and when he puts them there, they are not just curiosities in the white press, just, you know, an odd thing, oh, how interesting, a person over 100, but they become a story of Black history. They become a story about Black involvement in the U.S. History from the time of the Revolution. His mind is at work. He is writing a book with scissors.
I got the impression that at least in the African-American community, there was some community among scrapbook makers, and that people didn't only make them for themselves, but they actually shared them and sort of they became a resource for the community. Can you talk a little about that? And also, was that true in feminist circles at all?
Yes. Well, I mentioned that Dorsey kept something he called Dorsey's Museum, and one of the items, the elements there, was his nearly 400 scrapbooks. So people did come and read them. His friend, Joseph W.H. Cathcart, who made over 100 scrapbooks and worked as a janitor in an office building, newspaper reporters from white newspapers came and saw that he had all these scrapbooks. I'm assuming that Black people came and actually read them and used them in some way. Again, no records beyond that. But somebody like L.S. Alexander Gumby, who was a salon host in the Harlem Renaissance, also made over 100 scrapbooks, beautifully made, very elaborate. And he's in a much later generation. He's not so much aggregating information as he is staging it in some respects. He makes little envelopes for things to that you have to reach in and get out the clipping, or he makes little frames. And they're beautiful to look at as well. And his salon was called Gumby's Bookshop, and sometimes Gumby's Scrapbook Studio. And people could come and hear talks or singing or other kinds of performances, and they could also look at the scrapbooks on his shelves. And that seems to be something people did. And that sort of continued. Now, he ended up, he left Guts and got a salary for a while curating his scrapbooks to Columbia University, and they've been used quite a lot by historians. You asked about women and women's scrapbooks, too, the feminist movement. A lot of early women's rights activists made scrapbooks partly to document their own work in the movement. Now, think about what it meant to be in the newspaper as a women's as a woman. We've all heard that adage that you shouldn't, that a lady is only in the newspaper when she's born, married, or dies. Now that's, I have never been able to track that down, actually, as far as I've tried, but women speaking in public, that was pretty daring. And so they'd written up in the newspaper, and sometimes that would be useful information to them about how to counter mistaken impressions about what they were saying, and they sometimes wrote back very vehemently, and saving it in the scrapbook was a way of marking their campaigns about that. You know, the Caroline Healy Dall, for example, speaking at an early women's rights convention in Boston in the 1840s, was very angry that when she started speaking for money, that she was written, that the newspaper wrote her up wrong, she felt. And so they wrote a very short article about her speech, which she felt was mistaken. And then she saves that in her scrapbook page. And then she saves this long, long piece that she wrote back to them as her letter to the editor, where she pulls apart practically every word of their four-line article. She seems to have shared her scrapbook certainly with her children. But again, that was a resource, how to pay attention to the press, how to fight back. Later on in the suffrage movement, in the 19-teens, when it got much more professionalized, suffrage organizations hired clipping services to do this scrapbook making on a more professional basis, or they formed their own clipping bureaus in-house, as, for example, the New York suffrage organization did. But they did also share them in another way, that is, they bequeathed them to one another. So you find these sort of chains of inheritance of scrapbooks. Susan B. Anthony made a set of, I think, I can't remember, 11 maybe scrapbooks, big ones, out of huge old ledgers that she was given by, she said, the businessmen of Rochester, whether that meant they voluntarily gave them or she acquired them somehow. But she pasted over these old ledgers, and she gave those to the Library of Congress, and she really worked hard to make sure they kept them, because they weren't so always so open to gifts. And so she wanted to make sure they were there, because after all, the suffrage struggle was still going on when she died. And that meant the Library of Congress was both a kind of risky place to put her stuff. That is, there were no women in Congress. And yet it was the place where the congressmen would come and be able to read what she had done. Scrapbooks are unique objects. They're like a manuscript, like a medieval manuscript that has no copy unless somebody sits and copies it. There were no photographic kinds of copying done when these were made. One scrapbook I looked at was by Alice Dunbar Nelson, who was an African-American writer. She was the widow of Paul Lawrence Dunbar, although they actually had separated some years before his death. But she had that name, Alice Dunbar, so she was, when she spoke in public, that was important cultural capital, that she was the widow of the most famous black poet. And she participated in a suffrage campaign in 1915 in Pennsylvania and kept a scrapbook carefully documenting that. And it's an amazing document because it's a more thorough one and more kind of, you can see it as a much more professional item than some of the earlier ones. She clearly had a press agent or, you know, somebody who sent out the photo of her, which was from, I think, 15 years earlier, so that she looks a lot younger in the photo than she really would have in real life. So that there's this shaping of her image, and you can watch her do that in her scrapbook. It's quite amazing. And her speeches otherwise aren't documented. She didn't seem to have saved them elsewhere, as far as I've seen anyway. And so they become a way of seeing what kinds of things she pointed out to her audiences. Now, she was speaking to men to persuade them to give women the vote. And that meant in Pennsylvania, that included black men, to persuade them. And she talked about how, men said that women shouldn't vote because the polling places were too dirty and too rough. And so she said, electoral politics is the only kind of dirt women haven't gotten into. Look, we're all clean. We have to clean. We do all this work. And she pointed out that black women were mainly working outside, you know, had to work for money outside the home, which was not being discussed in terms of women's, in terms of suffrage very much. So again, another insight into women's political involvement in ways that we don't otherwise see it.
Ellen Gruber Garvey is the author of Writing with Scissors, American Scrapbooks from the Civil War to the Harlem Renaissance. You can get it from IndieBound or Oxford University Press, as well as the evil but oh so convenient Amazon. She also has a really fun blog, scrapbookhistory.wordpress.com. We will link to it on our blog, which is, of course, kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com.